Jesus said, no one can serve two masters. So why is it that so many churches are trying to serve two different worldview masters? I'm John Lefferter. The program is Steel on Steel.
Steel on Steel. News, commentary, interview, and debate. An alternative information source for politics, religion, and global events. Now, here's the host of Steel on Steel, John Loeffler.
I mean, I thought it was a perfectly reasonable question. I mean, how do you serve two different masters? You know, you can't. When you have two different worldviews, one of them is always in the driver's seat and the other or others are along for the ride. And the same thing applies to what's going on in churches today. Hi, everybody. Welcome to Steel on Steel. News, commentary, interview, information, and debate, much of which you will not hear elsewhere. Our golden pledge for the last 31 years that we've been on the air has been to be an early warning service. And what we do is we connect seemingly unrelated dots in economics, politics, and religion, project seemingly unrelated trends, and then show you where these dots and trends are coming together just over the horizon where normally the herd doesn't see it. Herd's almost always running in the wrong direction. That's because they're listening to the mainline media, who, it's easy to sell this now, are looking in the rearview mirror quite often, and purveyors of narrative. They don't report news, they purvey narratives, and they do this by reporting some stories, not reporting others, reporting some facts, not reporting others. And since all of that's true, and 31 plus years ago, we went on the air to be an antidote to that, please do remember that your failure to be informed does not make me a wacko. We're going to look at the two Christianities that seem to be emerging now, which shouldn't surprise us. We were warned that was going to happen in the end time. But also, we'll take a look later on in the program. This is this week, the anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall, the 32nd anniversary, and also the anniversary of Kristallnacht. They both happen on the same day. What have we learned as cultural Marxism just roars through the Anglosphere from the former Soviet Union, especially when former Soviets are warning us that we're following the same path that Russia did prior to the Bolshevik Revolution in 1917. Okay, so one of the things that Christians like to engage in all the time, which is why I refuse to get involved in certain theological disputes once they get to a certain level, this is engaging in a thing called ditchism. And what they do is maybe they're in one ditch and then they discover something better on the other side of the road in the ditch over there. Maybe it's a change of faith, denomination, etc. And they jump out of one ditch, run clear across the road, jump into the opposite ditch and begin condemning everybody who's still in the old ditch, forgetting that the assignment is to drive down the road, not sit in the ditch. One of the other ditch issues that has confronted the church, and this is nothing new, but it kept emerging in the 20th century, is that good old nostrum of politics versus religion, especially where the secularist left have been chanting to us for over half a century that we have separation of church and state. What they mean by it is politics operates in its sphere, the church will operate in its sphere, but it has no right to make any comment on the politics. Every society has three legs: economics, politics, and the legal arm, and religion. You can't have a society without all three. They all interact. There's no way to separate this out. The one rule of statism that we have learned in the 20th century with Marxism is that if the church does not influence government, the philosophy of government will be forced down on the church. And that's the beginning of persecution. So how do we deal with that today? Because we have that situation whereby you have some churches that don't want to do anything in politics, and other churches have almost substituted politics and social justice for actually preaching the gospel, remembering that social justice means equality of outcome rather than equality of opportunity. Doug Morgan's joining me right now. He is host of the Uncommon Sense podcast, where he discusses these issues, and he recently jumped into this subject, the fool.
Yes, I did.
You know, what bothers me, you've actually raised the topic in your recent podcast with something that Francis Schaeffer brought up 40, 50 years ago, was the fact that the church had scuttered back into its churches, slammed the door shut, and said, we're just going to preach the gospel, which was really a euphemism, is we're not going to get engaged.
Yeah, on our podcast, we talk about the things that they call third rail things, and that is the things you don't touch, and that is Christianity and politics. And so oftentimes, the church does not want to get involved in politics or the government, and vice versa, the government says, boy, you Christians, you better stay out of government. So there's this whole thing of people, hey, we don't want to talk about that. We don't want to go there. And the church has been influenced in that way and said, okay, there is separation of church and state, so we can't even get involved in government. And of course, that's just not true, and it's not biblical. But I love what you're talking about with the ditches. Our God is a God of balance. He's not a God of extremes. And so oftentimes, we think that if we are all about being involved with government, if the church really is supposed to be involved in politics and influencing our society, then we're going to be all about that and leaving the Bible behind, and we have to let that society influence us.
Doug, before you go on, let's get a definition of extremes, because you use that a lot on the podcast you did. There's a danger here with extremes. What's your definition of that?
Okay. My definition would be, maybe a good way to say it would be, like, the progressive church represents that in many ways. So in other words, what it's saying is that the Bible or Jesus Christ or these type of things, these aren't really true things. You know, Jesus was just a man. But what is most important is our definition of love. And our definition of love means that we have to accept all these things that Christ said maybe were sin or are lesser priority, they're not spiritual, they don't have eternal value. And so we're going to do all of these things that are in a higher priority than what the church has been called to do. And the church has been called to lift people up within their faith, strengthen them in their spiritual walk, and release them to do the same around the world and make disciples of all men. And so we're to influence our society and not necessarily let society influence the church. Now, does that mean that our message as a church doesn't change with how people, you know, how they change and how society changes? Of course, our delivery and how we present it can change, but not the actual message. And so when the progressive church and some of these churches that are saying that Black Lives Matter or, you know, homosexuality is okay and all this kind of thing, they are allowing the society to then influence the church rather than the church influence society.
I think what we see happening is the mainline churches, and these were battles that started in the early part of the 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
The mainline church was getting its nose bloodied in battles like evolution versus science. In other words, that was a false dichotomy. But once you bought into that dichotomy, then you were sunk. So they were getting their nose bloody, and they'd withdraw from that. What they're doing in the progressive churches is compromising Christian truth and or doctrine for the sake of relationship. Dean Gocher laid this out 20 years ago in his book on Diaprax. You have relation versus position. If you're going to hold only to relationships, your positions are going to take a pounding. If you decide you're going to hold position at all costs, then your relationships are going to take a pounding, because only you and maybe your dog are going to be in the room by the time you're left. Okay. So that's what I see as the conundrum here.
Yes. So what happens is the church then falls, for lack of a better word, for doctrine that just isn't biblical. And they will say, okay, well, we're doing this for the sake of love, and we're doing this for inclusiveness. And they fall for all these things, and they'll have all kinds of scripture to try to show that what they're saying is true. But isn't that what the Bible says happens as we get closer and closer to end times here, is that these false doctrines will come up? The church will, even the elect, many times be swayed by that. And so that's what we're seeing here.
Yeah, so you have to ask the question then, what's your driving worldview? And what the progressive churches have allowed, they allow modern theory coming from atheists to be their primary. In other words, Jesus said, no man can serve two masters. He was talking about money and God. But in this case, it's the same thing, two different worldviews. And so they're willing to allow the Christianity to erode for the sake of embracing doctrines like Black Lives Matter. Black Lives Matter, when you state it like that, if you say, no, all lives matter, people are, I'm offended. Really? So you mean Asian lives, Hispanic lives, white lives, Native American, those lives don't matter? When you make a philosophical statement like Black Lives Matter, the reason Black Lives Matter is you have to start with the founding premise, which the scripture teaches, all lives matter because human lives matter before God. Black lives are a subset of all lives. Therefore, Black Lives Matter.
But that's because It's not about the Black Lives Matter. I mean, that's a great phrase, but that's not what it means to them. What it means to them is that Black lives are superior, or they believe that they have rights that the oppressors, whites or whatever, shouldn't have. They need to go above and beyond now because this other race had superior things within the society. And so now Black Lives Matter doesn't mean Black lives really matter. It means that we, as a minority, this particular race, wants specialty type of freedoms.
And, yeah, obviously, and so yeah, that's the meaning underneath. But actually, what I call the hoi polloi, the public, generally don't go that deep. They mean,
correct. You
know, you're talking about the true believers underneath that have a different agenda.
Yes.
The other people think Black Lives Matter and that the problem is all that whites are all racist. You can't sustain these things biblically, nor truth-wise.
No, and when you try to do that as a church, you then get away from the biblical aspects. And this is what we started off talking about. When you embrace these societal type of things, then you try to throw some scripture in there to try to defend it, then you are getting away from what you should be doing as a church. And that is influencing the society rather than the society influencing you.
So how do you strike a balance in this?
Well, I think what you strike a balance in is that, number one, you know your priorities. I mean, your priorities biblically, you have to know the word, and unfortunately, a lot of Christians don't know the word, but you understand priorities, and you say, okay, well, what are priorities? What are priorities of the church? Well, the priorities of the church are to obviously help people grow spiritually. We have a number of mandates where we're to meet together, to worship or pray together in corporate worship. And then taking those two, for example, oftentimes we see churches, even today, I know of churches today that are still barely meeting together and using the COVID restrictions or whatever in their area as an excuse of not meeting together for corporate worship and for corporate prayer. And these are priorities that we should be doing as a church. We have to know that these are our priorities. When other things come in conflict with those things, then we have to stand up and we have to say, this is what we've been called to do biblically by God. Now, are there other things that we can do as a church that ingratiate ourselves within society? Of course there are. But we have to know what our priorities are. And when we know those priorities and when we follow those things, and one of those things is we have to have an influence on society. And that's where we get into the governmental type of aspect. If we just completely withdraw ourselves from government or any area, that leaves a vacuum. That means that we are not influencing those areas anymore. And of course, those areas, you're not going to have biblical leaders. You're not going to have good men and women that have morals or values or whatever in those positions because we've withdrawn from that as a church. That's the other ditch. And so you have to be somewhere in the middle. You have to say, okay, what are our priorities as a church? Within that, then, okay, how do we not take that too far to where the society is influencing us instead of us influencing society? So we stay in the middle by knowing where our priorities are. And one of our priorities is to influence society. How do we do that? We do that by being involved in local governments or our national governments or whatever. We do that by being involved in the school system, in all aspects of society, because where we withdraw, that's where the vacuum happens.
And the vacuum will be filled. I mean, that's
yeah,
the important thing to remember.
It always will be filled.
Yeah.
So
you've actually waded into that other question, and that is, how much should churches be involved? Always the 501c3 exemption comes up. Except that I've always maintained that I don't think the government's willing to test that one because it would be found unconstitutional. That's strictly something that was built into the IRS code. And so far, no church that I know of, I could be wrong, I have to go check this, has really come under sanctions due to that. But dang, it's been a very effective lever. It was part of the Johnson Amendment, you know, Lyndon Johnson, who later became president of the United States, because he didn't like the idea that churches were having so much input and shaping what was going on in politics, and he wanted them out. Same thing for secular humanists. When they first came in, Secular Humanist Manifesto 1, they said, well, we're going to be a new religion. We don't need God. We can form a religion of man. They admit it. It's a religion. Well, when it became convenient to no longer say, we're not a religion, we're teaching truth or science or this, then they quit calling themselves a religion so they could throw the church out of schools and academia and keep themselves in. That's what happened historically.
Yeah, what happens is the church gets scared, and what they do is they tend to withdraw from things that they're going to be scared over. And so when those type of accusations get thrown out, hey, we're going to come for your nonprofit status, boy, you better not do that because we're going to take you out there. Then they just simply withdraw, and they say, okay, fine, we're just going to concentrate on the spiritual things. And so they remove themselves from that kind of thing. Or they'll even go, you know, with scriptures like from 1 Peter 2 that says, well, we're supposed to submit to our authority. And of course there is that there as well, but unfortunately, if you really start to do some digging here, the Greek word for submit in 1 Peter 2 and other places. It's hupotasso, which basically means it's the same word that we use for husband and wife and the submission role there. And as a church, we don't say, well, you're supposed to do anything and everything and just be a slave type of thing to your husband if you're a wife. No, there's another word for that, and that's hupokuo. But what's happening here with the submission word here for submit to government authority, it's an orderly manner underneath is what it's talking about. And what that means is God set up government for a reason. He set up government because he's a God of order and not chaos. And so he set up the institution of government, and he set it up for good reasons, not for evil reasons. If we see a government that's asking us to do things that are outside of our priority list when it comes to a church, then we can't follow those things. And we should be able to submit to a good government, but stand up to things that are not correct and are not biblical and are not right. And unfortunately, the church just simply withdraws themselves.
It was a prescription against anarchy, which just leads to chaos and all sorts of nonsense.
Yes.
But exactly. I will always point out that here's the problem that they run into with this argument. Who is your authority? And the answer is, this is a government of the people, by the people, and for the people, who elect representatives to act in the governing power, who operate under a covenant agreement called the Constitution. If they violate their half of that, we have the responsibility for reining that in. Okay, and before God, biblically, you have to carry that out.
Yes.
If you don't want to do that, go live in a dictatorship or under a king.
Yes, our God is a God of order. And yes, who is our authority in that? And we can't take it to the other ditch. We can't do it like what the zealots said. And this is what, in Romans 13 and 1 Peter and all, this is, I believe, what is being talked about here. It's really being talked about what the zealots used to believe. The zealots of the time basically said, we're in the other ditch. We are only going to recognize the authority of God. We do not recognize the authority of any man. It doesn't matter what it is. It doesn't matter if it's taxation. It doesn't matter if it's any kind of law whatsoever. We do not recognize you. And what he's saying is, hey, I set up the institution of government, and so give to Caesar what is Caesar's, so taxation or whatever, go do that. But it doesn't mean that you have to bow down and show your belly to any leader that says boo. That's not the biblical, again, that's the other ditch. And so what we're not supposed to do is we're not supposed to separate ourselves from society. We're not supposed to say absolutely everything that has to do with man, we're not going to have anything to do with. I mean, it's tempting at times, right? It's tempting to say, wouldn't it be really awesome to have this really cool community where we just follow God? But unfortunately, we have a human nature. It's the way God made us. We have this nature. It's going to show its ugly head. So God knew that, and he set up a government, and he set up a church, and we are to influence that government. And that's where that staying out of the ditch is. That's the center lane, where we are involved in all of these things. We have influence in these areas, and we stand up against evil, and we stand up against those that would want to commit evil and want to come against the church.
Okay, so you walk into the church, and it represents one political position, one political party, which doesn't mean, by the way, that all parties are in the right. You know, I don't buy that nebulous thing. But there was a gentleman in our church a long time ago. I'd walk into the entry area, and if he would see me across a whole crowd of people, he would make this beeline across the lobby there and want to start talking politics. And I was trying to dodge him, like, please, give me a break from it. I do this all week long. I don't want to do it here. And how do you avoid that?
Well, I think, again, our God is a God of balance. And so there's always going to be those that have a passion. That's their strength. God wired us all differently. And for some, it's a passion for whatever. I mean, in this case, with this gentleman, it was a passion to see governmental change or whatever the case may be. I love to fly fish. I love to even disc golf and this type of things. Some of these outdoor activities, I really love those things. But if I let those things take higher priority in my life than they should, then I'm going to be way out of balance, and I'm going to be very annoying to other people. It's a matter of staying in balance. Our God is a God of balance. And so we know that when we get passionate about something, and that's what he's called us to do, oftentimes he gives us passion for it. But if we get it out of whack, then we obviously need to reel that back in. And what people like that need to understand is use that passion in a good way. So God is giving you this gift. He's given you this mandate even to go and work in this area. But let's see see how that can be channeled. It's just like a child, like my children. I've had to see how they're wired, see what they're good at. Maybe one's really good at art or whatever, and say, you know what, that's an area you might want to expand in. But at the same time, you have to help them understand that that's not all there is to life either. It is one of those things that it's just a matter of maturing and growing and understanding that we have priorities in our life. God is number one. And then when we get into some of these areas, you know, there's a word in Ecclesiastes, and it's called hevel. And hevel means smoke or vapor. And what we translated in the Bible is vanity. And it's used over and over in Ecclesiastes as everything is just vanity. You know, I looked at all these different things. I looked at pleasure. I looked at power. I looked at wealth. I looked at all these things, and it's all hevel. And what he's saying is it doesn't have any eternal value. It might have value just temporarily or whatever. I might really enjoy that pleasurable thing. But in the end, it's like wrapping my arms around smoke. It's all hevel. As a church, we need to make sure that what we're doing is not wrapping our arms around hevel, that we are actually having an influence on society, not just for power's sake or control's sake. If we're doing that as a church, then that's the wrong priority. We should be doing that for eternal value's sake. What is it that we're doing? Well, we're trying to maintain a government in the form of the United States that was given to us by God. It was set up under biblical principles and has had throughout history now, our history, has had an enormous impact on the world and the spreading of the word throughout the world. And so we know that. We can see that. And it's up to us to maintain that. America is a gift from God. And the church is required to help maintain that. That is eternal value. That isn't hevel. And so we need to look at things as, what are we doing? Are we doing things within our priority list? And are we doing these things for a reason and for a good eternal reason?
I take it you're trying to say you don't want to see hevel on earth, right?
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Doug Morgan, host of the Uncommon Sense podcast, there at uncommonsensepodcast.com. And he had two podcasts, Two Extremes of Christianity and Christians in Government Authority. And I know I'm recording the one you've got up most recently, but I haven't listened to it yet.
I really appreciate it, John. It's been an honor to talk with you on this, and I do appreciate you.
This is a real hard topic in terms of executing it, because people tend to divide up in one camp or the other. And in reality, it's a balance. You have to achieve that in the way churches deal with things. However, at the very same time, you will discover that the mainline churches tend to line up on the progressive side of the slate, having jettisoned much church doctrine. And the other people on the other side have lined up on the conservative side of the slate, having sacrificed themselves oftentimes to political positions. I used to like the slogan for the Evangelical Presbyterian Church: in essentials, unity, and non-essentials, diversity, and all things charity. At the same time, again, see how delicate this is? There are all sorts of factors in here. You also have to deal with the idea that there is truth, there is falsehood, there is correct doctrine, there is incorrect doctrine, at least as far as essentials, and the teachings of the faith in regarding social issues. So the question there is, what is driving your train? Is it biblically, or is it the latest stuff that's come down from the neo-Marxist postmodern? Earlier that was just neo-Marxist secular humanist crowd. Which one is driving? Only one will drive the train. If it's the wrong one from a reference point, then you don't want to be there. And so these are all issues that tie together. See, I remember when I travel, I like to go to different churches, and I was at an evangelical Lutheran church, ELCA, and having a wonderful conversation with a man about the inerrancy of the scriptures who goes to this Lutheran church. And he said, well, these are just written by men. They're not inspired by God. They're not inerrant. And I finally just asked him, why do you even bother to come here? Oh, well, it's a nice community. People care about each other. So you see where you come down on these types of things. Richard Vornbrown said there are actually two types of people in churches: those who think they are Christians and those who really are. And he said the only time you'll ever really know the difference is in a time of trial or stress, and then by what they do, not by what they say. So the balance that you're trying to achieve as a Christian, Dean Gocher was right. If you tie in totally to relationship, it's love, we accept everybody, you reject position, and you become amorphous and unable to do anything because you have no position. They actually do have a position. It's what I call militant mediocrity. Anything that contradicts it, they can't deal with that, largely because they are emotionally and feelings driven. The flip side of that are the people who become extremely doctrinaire. I want nothing to do with those people. I have been dropped on my rear end by those people. I would not want to be in a firefight with them, because the moment you take one step out of the line of what they perceive to be their orthodoxy, they're gone. And Paul himself said in 1 Corinthians, you can get all your doctrine right, but if you fail in love, you fail in that faithfulness, it is worthless. That's going to be a battle. It's always been a battle. It's been a balancing act, and it's gone on for the 2,000 years that the church has been there. So don't be surprised. Just understand the playing field. On behalf of producer Steve Schiller, I'm John Loeffler. We're at steelonsteel.com. The program is Steel on Steel. This is this week the anniversary since the fall of the Berlin Wall. Why is that significant today, especially given the push that we have for cultural Marxism, always being assured that Marxism will work and that we didn't really see the true Marxism, well, after numerous tries and disastrous failures every time? Will the real Marxism please stand up? You know, in a speech at Westminster College in Fulton, Missouri, 5th of March, 1946, that was Winston Churchill's famous statement that an iron curtain has descended across the continent, all the way from Stettin in the north to Trieste in the south. Barbed wires, barricades, machine gun towers, walls were going up, sealing off the captive nations divided by the Soviet Union from all of their neighbors in the West, collapsing, of course, what had been the hopes of many during World War II, that freedom would indeed prevail. We keep hearing how we defeated the scourge of Nazism, failing to recognize that the scourge of communism actually killed, imprisoned, and destroyed the lives of far more people than the Nazis ever did. But you don't hear that so much from the media because they're on the left, and anything on the left has to be good. You can see that in statements such as the Spanish publication El País. For example, when Pinochet died, the dictator in Chile, they said, you know, dictator, blah, 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 dies without paying for his sins. But when Castro, who did exactly the same thing as Pinochet, who has always been the darling of the left-wing media in this country, died, it says the founder of Cuba's socialist government dies. Same paper, totally different views of the very same types of people. That's the double standard that we're always dealing with in today's media. You know, I think it's instructive from a religious standpoint that the fall of the Berlin Wall, which was really the indication of the beginning of the collapse of everything, that was on November 9th in 1989, happened 51 years to the day of Kristallnacht, when mobs ran through Germany, destroying Jewish shops and attacking Jews everywhere. That was the beginning of a major change. Remember that the Wannsee Conference, the Organization for the Final Solution, didn't occur for another 4 years. But that was the real beginning of the Shoah. And you know, God does put a blessing and curse for those people who love Israel, that he'll bless those who bless you and curse those who curse you. And indeed, the nation of Germany was cursed for 51 years, being divided and split, and much of it in bondage, as well as those countries which had not dealt well with the Jews. They themselves found themselves in bondage. Why is it we don't seem to learn the history of Marxism? Because we're having all these battles here. You know, Black Lives Matter, two of the three founders are just avowed Marxists. Well, that should raise a huge red flag. But for today's millennials and Gen Zs and a lot of Gen Xers, they don't remember that. They don't remember the Cold War. They don't remember the evil empire. Indeed, if we go back to Churchill and what happened at the conference between Stalin and Roosevelt and Churchill at Yalta, they basically gave away for the sake of winning the war and keeping Stalin as an ally. They gave away and sold all of these other countries in slavery, countries themselves who had been fighting against the Nazis. Poland was betrayed. Great Britain had ostensibly entered the war on behalf of Poland, and Poland became little more than a satellite of the Soviet Empire. Its population was imprisoned behind a line of barbed wire. Remember that the secret police were required to spy on everybody. The Berlin Wall, when it went up in the 1960s, had to be manned by 15,000 guards, then called the Volkspolizei, meaning the People's Police. Remember that in 1948, when Josef Stalin attempted to starve West Berlin into submission by cutting off all electricity and supplies, the Western powers, on June 23rd of that year, had to respond with the Berlin airlift, and it broke the blockade. They began flying supplies into West Berlin. West Berlin was kept alive by an airlift of over 150 aircraft, bringing in about 5,000 tons of supplies a day. The Soviets finally ended the blockade almost a year later in May of 1949, and over 2.5 million tons had been delivered at the cost of 60 aircrew who had died in aircraft crashes. Then we careened directly into the Korean War, and following the death of Stalin in 1953, there was a huge protest in East Berlin where workers, supposedly the people that were represented by Marxism, protested against the Soviet occupation, and two Soviet armored divisions had to be sent into East Berlin to crush the protest in June of 1953. 100 civilians were killed, 25,000 protesters arrested. Nobody knows how long they stayed in jail. July of 1956, a full-scale uprising in Hungary shook the Soviet Empire. Again, the people rising up against the people's government. Mass demonstrations demanding the withdrawing of Soviet troops. The Berlin Wall was actually the proof of the failure of scientific atheistic socialism. In a free society, you have great difficulty keeping the people out. They want to come in and join it. Look at what's happening on our southern border. In totalitarian societies, and we could look at North Korea, China, Iran, they have great difficulty keeping the people in. And since people had been fleeing from the East German zone into the Western zones, they finally put up a 165-kilometer-long wall to seal off West Berlin's Island of Freedom from Soviet-occupied communist East Germany. Between 1961, August, and July of 1983, 73 people were killed by communists trying to escape over the Berlin Wall. 182 more people were killed attempting to escape from East Germany into West Germany. 60,000 people were imprisoned for preparation, assistance, or complicity. By 1989, at least 239 escapees from East Berlin were known to have been killed just at the Berlin Wall alone. And more than 1,000 died trying to flee across the Iron Curtain. President Putin of Russia recently gave a very important speech. One of the things that he pointed out is that what's happening in the United States today, and he was thumping very hard on the United States, resembles what happened in Russia during the Bolshevik Revolution of 1917, that we were making the very same mistakes, and he is correct. When you see people pushing for censorship, businesses enforcing politically correct thought, which was exactly what the Soviets did, businesses would have an officer, a commissar there, whose job was to make sure that all the workers thought the right thoughts and nobody expressed the wrong thoughts. That's precisely what's happening today. We are staring into the face of naked Marxist totalitarianism one more time. Thankfully, a lot of people are waking up to that. But we have to come down to an important question. Why is it we don't seem to learn those lessons? The answer is pretty straightforward. Our American schools haven't been teaching that history. They've been doctoring the history to match their own political narratives, which are aligning much more favorably with totalitarianism and Marxism than actually with the concepts of free markets and freedom. And that's why we are in the crisis that we are today. But I wanted to talk about all of this with Reuben Johnson. Reuben is our correspondent who lives in Kiev. He spent a lot of time in the former Soviet Union. He writes for military and strategic publications. He's fluent in Russian, and he understands the society. There are things happening in Russia which are actually affecting us here today, lessons which we should have or should be learning. So, Reuben, why don't you start with that thought?
Well, first of all, there's a great deal of nostalgia in the former Soviet Union for that time period. People think about, we had a space program, we put the first man into space, we had the first satellite before that. Caviar was so wonderfully inexpensive, you could eat it by the spoonful. But all this nostalgia, and there's a persistent strain of that, that all the things that were good about the Soviet Union that have gone away. And it causes people to not think about all the negative aspects, which were, of course, you know, there was no freedom of speech and there was absolutely no freedom of opportunity. And you'd always hear stories about people that when they had a chance to buy a 7-year supply of laundry soap, they would buy it because it might be another 7 years before you had a chance to buy it again. I mean, that's how disastrously upside down all of the distribution system was. We think we have supply chain problems now. Secondly, we tend not to focus on what happened in the former Soviet Union because the nation did break apart and it turned into a whole bunch of independent countries, including this one, Ukraine, that I live in. People don't seem to realize that the Soviet Union is gone, but within Russia, a lot of the Soviet mentality is not. the mentality that says that the West is evil, the West is corrupt, the West has all of these evil influences, the West is trying to destroy our culture and way of life. This runs a gamut from things like there are too many English words that have become common day in Russian. It runs that to the present day where you have, you know, Vladimir Putin condemning the United States, saying, well, don't lecture us about human rights, you know, when you are allowing children to become transgendered before they even know what that really means. And don't lecture us about this. We get to the present day, and what do we see? Well, we see Vladimir Putin, who spoke recently for 3 hours at this conference in Valdai in the Crimea. He had a lot of harsh words to say about the United States, but what he's been saying is, gee, what are you guys doing in America that you used to criticize us communists for? You're taking things that people said or wrote maybe 30 years ago, and you're deciding that now today that what they said or wrote was ideologically unacceptable, and you're making them enemies of the people, and you're pulling down statues, and you're changing the names of streets, changing the names of squares. And oh yeah, you're putting ideological constraints on market activity. You're no longer allowing the invisible hand of the marketplace to dictate what your policy should be on one part of the country's economic activity. You're appointing incompetent people because you think that the act of virtue signaling that that entails is great, but these incompetent people can't manage the responsibilities given to them, and this creates other types of disruptions. And he seemed to be saying, that's great, you guys keep doing that, because we tried that in 1989, the Soviet Union collapsed. And this is what the scary part is. In the sane world, politics is supposed to be downstream from culture. The left wants it the other way around. Everything that we do, everything we say, everything we read, everything we think, it has to be dictated by some sort of a political agenda. That's a very dangerous idea.
Well, it's especially dangerous when the disparity between reality and the ideology, the tension gets greater and greater and greater. So, as you say, usually it's flipped around the other way. Much of what we're seeing in terms of what you're doing is this cultural Marxist creep, and it's driven by academia, and that's what you're facing here, but you recognize it.
I recognize it. I mean, I remember this was funny at the time, but now it's not so funny because it's actually becoming reality. But it's about 1992 or something like that, and I'm given a presentation. I've just come back from what had been the Soviet Union as it's falling apart, and I'm out at the Defense Intelligence Agency, and I'm given a briefing on all this stuff, and someone says, what are we going to do? Aren't these people still communists? And I said, guys, wake up. The only communists left in the world are in America, and they're teaching at Harvard, at Princeton, and Yale. And everybody laughed, you know, because it's funny back then. But what we're seeing now is that so many of these ideas of the progressive left have their genesis somewhere in academia, not in real life. You know, critical race theory, the fact that climate change is the greatest threat in our lifetime. So many of these ideas which are being advocated by the progressive left and cause, you know, immense disruptive economic activity, and the suggestion has been made by other people, not me, although I would agree with it, is that our HR departments in the United States are the functional equivalent of the old Soviet political commissars. They find you're stepping out of line and you're saying the wrong thing or thinking the wrong thing. They come down on you like a ton of bricks. I mean, this is no way to live. There was I don't want to use his name because people will immediately go out and start searching for it, but there was an executive for the Boeing company who had been appointed as a press and public relations guy, press and communications, and it was a pretty difficult job because he'd been handed this job in the wake of the Boeing 737 MAX disaster. He was forced to resign because 30-some years ago, he'd written an article for the Naval Institute magazine Proceedings. He'd written the article as a military officer at the time. He was on active duty, and the article that he had written was a discussion of what was then actual policy within the armed forces. And it was about women being in frontline combat positions. And the article was not an op-ed. It was not a polemic. It was more like an academic discussion, which included footnotes. And the footnotes were from military officers, which were his superiors. And the article said, there's no question that women are capable of piloting combat aircraft. They're capable of driving tanks. They're capable of doing all these things in combat. That's not the issue. The issue is, what does that do to unit cohesion? And we don't know the answer. Someone claimed within Boeing that the article had quote unquote resurfaced, and they were offended, and he was forced to resign over something he'd done back when he was on active duty before the policy changed.
But you also noticed that he told the truth. It was an unknown. We didn't know what that would do.
But see, the worst part about it for me is that I said, okay, knowing his name and knowing the subject and knowing the publication, I tried to find this article, and Proceedings has the most abysmally bad archive system. And even knowing what I was looking for, I had a hard time finding it. So I have a hard time accepting the interpretation that this article resurfaced. No, the only way it could resurface is if you're Jacques Cousteau. This is becoming predatory. It's becoming like the French Revolution. It's like, oh, well, if I denounce someone and I bring them down, I'll get their job. And I find this incredibly dangerous that we're allowing this to go on.
Fortunately, there are a lot of Americans, both Democrats and Republicans, who have recognized something is radically wrong. I mean, there have been articles by Dershowitz now and other Democratic Party mainstays that are saying, whoa, something is radically off kilter here. I think that's a positive.
I'd like to believe you're right. What I find disturbing now is that all of these extremely destructive and dysfunctional political aspects of the old Soviet Union are making their way or have found a new home with the progressive left. But all of the belligerent and expansionist tendencies of the old Soviet Union remain in Russia. The structure of the system by which the Communist Party operated still remains. And I'll just give you an example of what I mean by that, is if you drive through Moscow and you go around Red Square, because you can't drive through Red Square, and you go through the area which is called the Old Square. And this was the old Communist Party of the Soviet Union Central Committee. And this was the most important, powerful, and influential building in the entire country. This is where all the big decisions were made. So I went past there the last time I was in Moscow, and the facade of the building has been spruced up and cleaned, and it's got brand new bulletproof, soundproof windows, and there are wonderful brand new modern air conditioning units outside and so on. This complex of buildings is no longer the Communist Party Central Committee. It's now the presidential administration. This old Soviet system of government still remains, in which, yes, there's a parliament, but the parliament doesn't really do anything. Putin governs by a presidential decree. All the decisions are made within the presidential administration. You know, there's a Russian state central bank, but the state central bank doesn't set interest rates. A group in the presidential administration does, and it tells the bank what rates to post every single day. All of the decisions that mean anything, and ministries and agencies and all of the mechanisms of government, are simply mechanisms for transmitting decisions that have been made by this group of people sitting in this building across from Red Square, across from the Kremlin. So in many respects, the presidency of Vladimir Putin and the presidential administration has even more power than the Communist Party did back in the old days, because there's no checks or balances anymore as there were back in Soviet times.
The real one, I think you pointed out, was, and I remember Richard von Braun talking about this when he was in prison in Romania. There were Communist Party functionaries in prison with him that had fallen afoul of the system, oftentimes for corrupt political purposes. That's an important thing to point out. And these people were true believers in communism, but they just thought it was just the corrupt system. But corruption seems to follow Marxism hand in glove.
Well, it does, because you're operating in an environment where it's not like in Western countries where you can serve in government, and then when you leave government, you can cash in by taking some position in private industry that pays more money. The only place where there's any money flowing through anywhere that you can access is inside of the government system. And this is one of the reasons that the Soviet Union collapses, is that it becomes a fundamentally dishonest and corrupt society. Unlike the early days under Stalin, people who got caught with their hands in the cookie jar were no longer being executed. And now in the present day, under Vladimir Putin, high-ranking people are getting caught in one scheme or another, and absolutely nothing is happening to them at all. It's almost as if there's no punishment. It's like that old adage that I remember one time many years ago, I was in Austria, and someone was complaining about the fact that the brand new airport terminal, the construction had been halted for months and months and months and months, because it turned out someone had made off with all the money, but nothing had happened to them. And the lady I spoke to said, you know, you steal 3 tins of beer from a convenience store and you go to jail for 6 months, but you steal millions of dollars on a construction project and nothing happens to you. Well, that's everyday life now in the Russian Federation. And it's assumed proportions that I could have never even imagined. I've written plenty of articles about, here is a factory in the middle of nowhere, here's a military base in the middle of nowhere, and here's some corrupt colonel or major or something. But it's now extremely high-ranking members of the Russian military and the Russian government are being caught in all kinds of corruption schemes, and nothing happens.
Let's move to some of the geopolitical issues now that we've done some background. I thought it was important for Americans to hear this, because this is unknown material. All right, so if we look at the Harris-Brandon administration. They're turning right now a blind eye to what Iran and China are doing in terms of oil deals. Now, these are prohibited by sanctions, but, you know, here we go again.
Well, this is the old thing. This goes back to the Obama era, that we're not going to clamp down on the Iranians because Biden has this equal obsession that Obama did with the Iran nuclear deal. So this is the way to get Iran back to the negotiating table, is to simply pretend not to know that these illegal oil transfers are going on. And of course, exports of oil from Iran are one of the few ways that country makes any money. And the Chinese are more than happy to buy it because, number one, the Chinese need oil imports. Number two, they're happy to have a stronger relationship with Iran because Iran is a balancer against their enemies in the West. And number three, it gives them influence in the Middle East. And oh, by the way, Iran is a potential candidate to buy a bunch of Chinese weapons because Iran's military is using hardware, and most specifically fighter aircraft, which are so old, they're almost flying museums. So all of these things, China benefits from this and Iran benefits from this. And you say, okay, so what were the point of the sanctions in the first place if you're not going to enforce them?
A lot of times we do things for show. It's like when Kerry comes back from the Paris climate. We just had COP26, which I call cop-out, since the Chinese and the Russians were no-shows. And they say, you know, this was great. We worked hard on this deal. And then you look at the details of it. It's not going to do anything. Most of the countries aren't meeting their targets. They have no intention of meeting their targets. It's all hot air. At least Greta Thunberg is that one canary in the coal mine. Whatever you think about it, being a fanatic activist against global warming, she's saying this was a nothing. It was a blowover. And you recognize that's what it is. And as countries are steering themselves into an energy crisis, eyes wide open.
Well, okay, yeah. I saw Nigel Farage the other day speaking about this, and he says, oh, this is great. He says the people who actually showed up at this conference represent 4% of the real harmful pollution that's put into the atmosphere every day. The others aren't there. So assuming everyone follows all of these guidelines and they agree to these restrictions and they agree to try to reduce their carbon footprint, okay, congratulations. You're only going to impact that 4% of the people who actually showed up. And the rest of the world is going to have the most expensive energy that there ever was. So what are you going to do? You're going to make the rest of the world like California, where you have these insanely high prices for petrol and you have these insanely high rates per kilowatt hour. I mean, this just shows the intellectual bankruptcy of this current crowd in Washington. I mean, America was a net energy producer. We were exporting. We were independent of foreign fossil fuel sources until Biden comes in. Biden comes in and he says, okay, we're going to cut this pipeline. We're going to do this. We're going to do that. No more fracking, blah, blah, blah. And so now his answer is to go to the Russians and the Saudis and ask them to pump more oil to make up for the stuff that America is no longer producing. And then go to a conference and talk about, oh, we need to reduce carbon emissions. I can't make these ends meet. I'm sorry.
Well, a lot of it's very much like California in that California has played all these games, and now they finally admitted, shucky-doo, we may have to fire up some natural gas plants. But the dirty secret is they've been buying power from across the border in Mexico, which doesn't have all those environmental constraints. All the while, they're prancing around talking about how they're going green and reducing the carbon. You know, it's totally hypocritical. It's all for political purpose rather than for reality.
It's hard to tell where is the greater toxicity. Is it the California model for destroying their ability to provide affordable energy to the people who live in the state? Or is it the political toxicity? Remember, these are the same people who, during this recall election, said that Larry Elder was the black face of white supremacy, whatever that means. I still haven't been able to figure that one out.
It all tends to be a word game. It drives a sane, logically thinking person nutso. But remember, large amounts of younger generations have not been taught to think logically, but in consensus and authority-driven type of thing, which takes us full circle to what we were talking about at the beginning.
I have to blame, I'm sorry to say this, but I'm incredibly disdainful of the U.S. educational system at this point, because like the Soviet Union, we're not producing people when they come out of these institutions. We're not creating people with an education that teaches them how to analyze, deduce, think logically, take a set of facts, use a mode of analysis to come up with a conclusion. None of those things. People are coming out and they've been given an entire list of slogans. They've been given a bunch of rhetoric. They come out of the university and they don't know the details of anything about anything. They don't know how the world works. They don't know how other countries operate. They don't know the history behind major world events. But they do know one thing, There's one thing that they absolutely know beyond any shadow of a doubt. And that one thing is, if there's a major problem somewhere in the world, it must be America's fault.
That, of course, goes back to where we were in the days of the Soviet Union. Remember that? It was the same issue. The Soviets would always accuse us of what they were doing. It was like clockwork. Vox Day wrote in his book, Social Justice Warriors Always Project. He said the very same thing. He said, they know they would do this. And so they can't imagine that their opponents might be operating on a different type of moral clock. And they project that out on their opponents in the ideological war. So before we wrap out, anything else? I notice that Boeing is probably relying on contracts from China now to keep itself going.
Well, aerospace is one of those few areas in American industry where the United States still has a huge lead over everybody else. I mean, we lost our dominance in the automobile industry and in what we used to call, you know, the white appliances, the refrigerators, the washing machines, and so on. The things, so many things that America used to make, we have left America's shores and are built someplace else. But aerospace is one area of American expertise, one of the few left. And it's really been given a body blow by COVID. One, because air travel in general just has dropped off precipitously. And secondly, because the American air carriers are all so bad and their fleets are all so old that Boeing has become dependent in very great measure on sales of aircraft abroad to the big airlines that are spending lots of money. And at one time, they were making a lot of sales to China, but those sales aren't going to be there. The Chinese are not going to be buying Boeing aircraft in large numbers. The Chinese have their own commercial aircraft program called the C919, which they have talked about and talked about and talked about. It's finally, supposedly, going to be making its debut. And I could go into a lot of details about this program, but the Chinese have sunk immense resources into this. They've gone after this program like it was the race to the moon. It's been financed with government money. When the aircraft is finally into production and it's being flown and it's demonstrated that it's actually a safe design, it will be shoved down the throats of Chinese state-owned airlines, whether they want it or not. But this is going to be taking the place of sales that Boeing otherwise would have been making on its own. And they're going to be forced in the position of building airplanes, what we call whitetails. A whitetail means that it's an airplane being built and there's no customer for it yet. So this is another one of many instances where the hangover from COVID, you know, we may get to a point where we're actually able to move around the world and we don't have to wear masks everywhere and we don't have to get tested every 5 minutes. But the hangover economically is going to continue long after we get back to some normal way of daily life, if we ever do.
Yeah. And what's even stranger is, you know, we're supposed to be building back better. You might as well call it build back bankrupt. Here we are. People are out of work. We're paying a lot of people not to work. And because of this COVID controversy, we're laying off thousands of people. You have to picture this. And my wife says it's deliberate. They want to take people who are politically incorrect and move them out of the system. There's that ideological drive. And I think there's a lot of truth to that. You can't rationally say you're doing what they're doing because they say, well, if you don't take the vaccine, you're endangering others. Now, wait a minute. Even if you do take the vaccine, you still can give it to other people. It doesn't prevent you from getting it. You're still contagious if you pass it on. You just get a lesser case. And if somebody else is vaccinated, how am I endangering them? None of this makes any sense to anybody talking rationally, but all of the media people, including even our local stations, they're all marching in lockstep with this stuff.
Well, this is having disastrous effects, not only on how we live our daily lives, but look what's happening. I mean, people are fleeing the major cities. You look at the news now and you realize that Chicago is now set to become the new Detroit. I listened to a commentator the other day who said he was in downtown Manhattan, and he said, thank God everybody on the street is smoking marijuana because the smell of marijuana masks the smell of urine from all the people homeless that are urinating everywhere. We're destroying these cities. This is why you've got people fleeing to places like Texas and Florida, where there's no state income tax and they've got competent government. And they've found ways to deal with the COVID crisis other than shoving people into nursing homes where the most vulnerable people end up dying. I don't know how you recover from all this, but you talk to people now, or I do in the States, nobody wants to fly anywhere because they don't know if the plane's actually going to take off and are they going to end up standing in line for 6 hours or being on the phone for 8 hours. Nobody wants to go to these big cities because they're just disaster zones, you know, in tent cities in downtown Los Angeles and other major cities in the United States. I don't know where this is going to lead, but someplace like New York, they're going to need another law and order hardcore mayor like a Giuliani to clean the place up, or there's no hope for it.
It is interesting. All right, Reuben Johnson, I appreciate it. I won't do any takeaways today, I think, between the Borlaug at the beginning of the segment and Reuben's discussion with me. I think we've taken away everything we need to. That's why it is so important for people now to speak up. People are trying to hunker down. Hunkering down people allow evil to prosper. As Professor Jason Hill said on the program, why is it a noisy, violent, small group of people is able to hold the rest of us at bay? Because people will not speak up. So you have that choice. Here it is one more time. You can speak now and take the consequences. You may lose your job. Well, I've lost jobs too in this business for standing up and taking the consequences. So I don't say it lightly. I know what it's like. You can speak now and take the consequences or not be able to speak then, but you will still take the consequences. It's your choice. Just a matter of when. As we close out the show today, I was thinking sometimes you'll hear people trying to justify the idea of Marxism. Well, that wasn't really the true Marxism. Every time it fails, that's what they say. Socialism, of course, Marxism is built on a socialist platform. And every time it fails, they go, well, that wasn't the true Marxism, the true socialism. And so the question always is, will the real socialism please stand up? And they always want to take one more whack at it. And I keep thinking, well, how many more lives and destroyed economies are you willing to put on the line to do this? And the answer for the ideologues is quite a few. Marxism cannot work, it will not work, and above everything else, its principles and that of socialism are counter to the scriptures. But remember, everything we see going on right now is simply temporary. We're passing through, we hold our responsibilities while we're here, but ultimately God has a much better kingdom coming at a later date. We have to keep that in mind. Do pray for us for provision and protection. Pray for those suffering for their faith around the world and for those in charge of your governments at all different levels during this time of radical paradigm shift in the West. And remember, your ultimate reference points are on God and His Word. They're stable. They don't change. That's the important part. Everything else that people produce, it's constantly changing. On behalf of producer Steve Schiller and our special program producer Carol Leffler, I'm John Leffler. We are at steelonsteel.com. The program is Steel on Steel.
This has been Steel on Steel with John Leffler, an alternative information source for politics, religion, and global events. Steel on Steel is produced by Carol Leffler, engineered by Brad Grant. The views and opinions expressed on this broadcast are not necessarily those of the staff, management, owners, or advertisers of this radio station. Steel on Steel can be heard 24 hours a day on the internet at steelonsteel.com. CDs or online subscriptions support the ongoing program production. For more information, call toll-free 1-800-829-5646. That's 1-800-829-5646. This is the Steel on Steel Radio Consortium.